you have a Bible,
why don't you grab it and turn to 1 Peter, which is a book in the New Testament towards the end, written, we think, by a guy named Peter. You may have heard of him. Remember the guy that walked on water and got called Satan and all kinds of things? I'd explain that to my kids this week. That was one of the passages we read at breakfast, and like, that was not easy. Peter writes, we'll get to that in a minute, 1 Peter chapter 2. But what I actually want to begin with this morning is a little bit of Hebrew. Because every morning should have some Hebrew in it, really, you know, right? And Hebrew is a really beautiful language, although I can't make it sound beautiful. It's actually quite kind of guttural, and, you know, you get a little in there, you know, and I can't speak it well to make it beautiful. But despite that, it still holds a lot of beauty to me because it's a layered language. It's a very layered language. One word carries a variety of meanings, and this is true in most languages, but Hebrew especially so. And so I just want to say a word together, if we could. It's the word shevet. Shevet. Can you say it together? Everyone say shevet. Yeah, not bad, not bad. All right. And it's a word that shows up quite often in the Old Testament and can mean these things, among others, but these are its main meanings. It can be a rod or a staff, a big stick, okay, is the idea there. Or it can be a branch of a tree, or it can mean a tribe or a family, a clan, usually an extended family in size, not nuclear, but extended. Shevet. This word comes up all the time because in the Old Testament, and then it carries into the New as well, God is portrayed as a gardener. Someone who tends a vineyard, that's a very common image. There's also an image of a tree that God has planted, the tree of life. And on that tree are these branches or these extended families of people, these tribes. And believe it or not, this is actually where our church's name comes from. Did you know that? When I run into people and tell them what I do and what the name of the church is, you know, some who maybe are familiar with the Bible say, this is like John 15 where Jesus says, I'm the vine and you are the branches. That's where you get your name from. And I'm like, no, actually, that's not it. Great idea for a church name, but that's not where it comes from. Others who know my history, Andy's history a little bit, we both worked and were a part of a church called River Tree. So they think, it's just like a branch of the River Tree. And nope, that's not it either. You know, I hate to burst your bubble. It actually comes from this Hebrew word, shevet. Shevet. This idea in the scriptures we took and hoped and dreamed that this church that was going to start would be a family, a tribe together. Before we ever had a worship service, before we ever knew if anyone would even come, we had this dream of a family. A people might be another way to say it. And this is when we get to 1 Peter chapter 2. All right? So 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter writes this. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Peter writes, once you and I, we were not a people. And God was like, not good. I'm going to do something about that, right? Not having a people goes really against everything that God tries to do in the scriptures. So God decides to bring people out of darkness into light, out of individualness, individuality, disconnectedness into family and into tribe. This is what we've been made for. We've been made for family. We've been designed for tribe. It's a part of who we are as the new creation that God has made us to be. Never in the scriptures can you find God saying, hey, you know what? Just go it alone. That's cool. Chart a course out on your own path and just roll up your sleeves and get to work. It's fine. Head out there by yourself. That's never in the scriptures. We're always a part of something larger. Even when we're out there on our own, maybe doing work or fulfilling the calling that God has given us, we're always a part of a family, a tribe. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. The trouble, of course, right, guys? We live in a world that elevates, right? That elevates the person who can boast that they are self-reliant. This is the world we live in. We hold in high regard those who can say they don't need anyone else, right? This is the world that we live in. All around us, there are shows and advertisements and magazine covers that tell us that to live free or to be strong or to have power is to never need anyone. Our world tends to value person over people. And every time that our world values person over people, it reinforces something inside of us, a broken part of our humanity. It reinforces it and makes us go, yeah, I'm going to go it alone. I'm going to go it alone. This flawed part of our humanity has been there from the very beginning, actually. If you know the story of the scriptures and you go all the way back to the beginning, it began with two people who were becoming, they were going to be the start of God's family, the people of God. But something happened, things went awry, and they kind of went from people to person. And then the story of scriptures as it continues on is then going back again. Do you remember the beginning? Do you remember Adam and Eve? Remember the story? Thank you, I'm glad you do. Excellent, Eleanor. You know, God said to Adam and Eve, hey, it's all yours. It is all yours. And not just Eden, but a relationship with each other and with me, a oneness, a wholeness. It's all here for you. And then came this whisper. Hey, psst. You see that fruit over there? You should eat it. Because if you eat it, you won't need God anymore. It'll give you the knowledge of good and evil, the knowledge that only God has. If you eat it, you won't need God. And Eve is like, whoa. I think I remember God saying that if we eat that, it's going to cause harm. No. God's actually trying to hide something from you. God's trying to keep this power from you. You can't trust God. You're like, no, just go ahead. Eat it. You'll never need God again. That whisper still comes to us today. Go ahead. Head out on your own. You don't need God. You can trust yourself. You don't have to trust God. In fact, God might be actually trying to keep something from you. So just go it alone. See, here in Genesis 3, we see people, Adam and Eve, the start of God's family, move to persons, because we know the way that the story goes, don't we? In Genesis 3:16, after Adam and Eve eat of this fruit, all kinds of brokenness enters the world with creation, with God, in a number of ways, and with each other. We see this. This is the curse of the fall. Big theological language. It just means that things went really sideways in a hurry. And God says to Eve, you will want to control your husband because of this, because you've decided to go out on your own, but he will dominate you. You will want to control your husband. And by the way, if any of you are sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, so it's like only wives that want to control their husbands? Husbands also want to control their wives. Can we just like get that out on the table? And co-workers want to control co-workers. And neighbors want to control neighbors. and siblings want to control siblings, right? What happens here to Adam and Eve is representative of all of humanity. And that next phrase too, but he will dominate you. That's not just Adam dominating his wife. Again, this extends to all human relationships. We're often, all of us, trying to be first and most, right? That's what it means, I think, in short, to dominate. We all know this. Anyone here ever been in an argument? Raise your hand, anybody? Five, six? Okay, no, now it's growing, yes. Hannah, thank you. Hannah, I was going to stare at you until you rose your hand. Good. So, you know, we've all been in an argument. We all know what it's like. And anyone ever tried to win an argument? We're always in it to win it, aren't we? Yes, of course. So when you're in an argument, if you can, and most of us get pretty good at this, we calculate what to say and not to say in order to win. I'm going to withhold that about myself or about the situation, or I'm going to make sure I save that because I know it will push your button or it will cause this reaction, right? We do all kinds of things in order to win. Why do we do all of that? Because winning is a form of control. If you win, you're on top. And the other person who has now just lost the argument, I don't know, has to ask for forgiveness or has to bow to your will or feel badly about whatever. But it's a form of control when we fight and we try and win without humility and vulnerability. Anybody ever made a mistake? Thank you. Good. We're getting better at this. Good. Yes, lots of mistakes made, right? In an effort to control the person that maybe we've harmed or to dominate, to stay on top, what do? We cover it up. We downplay it. Oh, I hadn't had my morning coffee yet. I didn't mean to say that, you know. If only you had caught me a half an hour later, I never would have told you, bleepity bleep, you know. We blame someone else. We pass blame. We do whatever we can to control that situation, that mistake. Instead of vulnerability and humility, we choose control and dominance. Anybody ever kept someone else at arm's length? This is a form of control as well, right? Because if I keep you at a distance, if I don't fully share myself with you, then I'm performing a lot of manipulation and control in order to make sure that you only see the parts of me that I want you to see. I'm making sure that I stay on top. Again, I'm the one deciding what gets said and what gets shared and when it gets shared. When we keep people at a distance, when we don't fully invest our lives, we're living into this. It's Genesis 3 all over again. But listen again to 1 Peter 2. Jesus called you out of darkness, out of Genesis 3 and the mess that was. He's called you out of that into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Jesus is up to something. Make no mistake about it. And it is to move us back to a people. Look at 1 Corinthians 12. If, again, you have a Bible or you've got your phone or something, turn there. This is maybe one to study a little bit more this week because we're only going to read a section of it. And there's a lot that is said here about community and about tribe, about family. First Corinthians 12, I'm going to start in verse 12, and then we're going to jump down. Just as a body, though one, has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with Christ. Okay? One body, many parts. Then down to verse 21. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. When we live in that Genesis 3 sort of way, we say, I don't need you because I'm in control. I'm on top. I'm the most important thing. So I don't need you, frankly. I'll maybe interact with you. I'll maybe share some part of my life with you, but I will never fully integrate my life with yours so that we become one body. Because I really am not sure I need you. Verse 23, and the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty. Well, our presentable parts need no special treatment. That's a whole other sermon in that little section right there, right? But God has put the body together, giving greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. This is what Jesus is building. A body with many crazy, wonderful, exceptionally different parts, all of which matter, all of which are needed. Right? What we get in 1 Corinthians 12 is a picture of a people that have left the ways of Genesis 3 behind. And instead of trying to exercise control and dominance over one another, what do we see here? In this, we see persons becoming a people. We see humility and vulnerability, sorrows and joys being shared fully amongst the whole body. No division, no one trying to one-up the other or prove that they're more important than the other. They each have equal concern for each other. I got to tell you guys, I am tempted by that whisper of Genesis 3. I'm tempted by it often. And sometimes I give into it. I think that it would just be better to not invest my life, to keep it close to the chest, to never fully open myself up to other people. But then I read this, and my heart beats a little bit faster because I know in my soul that this is what we were made for. We are made to be a part of this kind of family, this kind of body, this kind of tribe. This is what we were created for. The question is, how do we get there? How do we get from the mess of Genesis 3 and the mess that is often our lives today to this picture of oneness and wholeness? How do we get there? That's actually what this series is devoted to. It's devoted to that question. How do we become a tribe? The kind of tribe that we see in the scriptures, a family, an extended family of people that look like this. And every week we're going to come at that from a different angle and try and think about that, how, what we might do and how we might act towards one another. But before we can get to any of the following topics of the next few weeks, we've got to look at something I think that is foundational to any tribe, to any family. It is absolutely critical to have. If we don't have it, we will never get there. And that thing that we need is trust. The first element of a tribe is trust. And guess what? I'm actually not talking about trust between each other. That will come. We'll get to that in future weeks, I'm sure, quite often. What I'm talking about today is our trust in God. because I don't think there's any way that you and I will choose to take the risk of investing our lives in a tribe unless we trust God. I don't think we can actually really trust each other unless we first trust God. So look at this verse from Proverbs 3, verse 5. You've maybe heard this before. Maybe you memorized it at some point along the way. It's a great, great verse. And we're just looking here at the first half of it. But it's enough for this morning, I think. The writer says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, with all of it. And do not depend on your own understanding. Now, confessional, I don't know about you, but I'm the kind of person who likes to depend on my own understanding. Anyone else? Kind of work out that way, you know? This passage sounds really nice, but it scares me to death. It's a great bumper sticker, but it terrifies me. Because I'm analytical. I make decisions based on reason and careful thought. Bethany's been trying to buy a rug for our living room for months. And I'm like, I don't know, we should really think about that one. You know, we should really evaluate all of our options. Look at 10 stores. Let's price it out. You know, let's create a spreadsheet. I want to think it through all the way to the end. Poor woman. You know, thankfully, she's not that way. I mean that, thankfully, or else we would never go anywhere or do anything. You know, we would just think about it all the time. We would just think. Because I depend on my understanding. And so often I do not move anywhere. I do not act until my understanding is satisfied. And this is true for me, at least, maybe for you too, when it comes to relationships, and when it comes to community, and when it comes to tribe. I want to have it all figured out. I want to totally understand where we're going and how we're going to get there before I take a first step, right? If you can't tell me that, I'm probably not interested. I want to know that you won't hurt me. I want to know that I won't be disappointed. I want assurance that there won't be pain, hardship, difficulty. Once you give me that, once my understanding has been satisfied, then I'll move. Oh yeah, then I'm in. You know, let's go. Where are we headed? Oh, that's right. I already knew that because you told me, right? You know, I'm in. I lean on my own understanding. For me, understanding leads to doing. Does that make sense? For me, understanding often leads to doing. And I get why, my hunch is I'm not alone in this. Hunch is we all have to wrestle with this to some extent. Maybe there are those of us that it's less so than others, but I'm not surprised that it's this way. Because my hunch is that every one of us, somewhere along the line, we have been wounded by tribe. We've been disappointed by family, by community. And so the idea of giving ourselves to it again, living with vulnerability, really opening up our lives, all of it, it terrifies us. Or maybe it's not so much that we've been hurt, but we look at tribes. Let's call it churches. We look at faith communities. And we see them fighting about the most ridiculous things, right? And we're like, why? Why would I be a part of that? They can't agree on a style of music. And it's ripping them apart. Cultural differences are causing all kinds of strain. differences in color of skin, theological issues that are on the periphery are tearing communities apart. And we look at that and we go, why in the world? Why in the world would I give myself to that? We want our understanding satisfied. We want to make sure things are going to work out. If you can guarantee that, you can promise that I won't be hurt, that there won't be disappointment, then I'll maybe give it some thought. Our understanding leads to doing. But Jesus tells us that in this life, it is the other way around. Jesus says to us, trust me. With all your heart, trust me. And as you step out and live and do, the understanding will come. See, in life, guys, doing often, if not almost always often, is what leads to understanding. When I was 18 years old, I had to have surgery. And my family had just moved down to Virginia. So I'm up here, Central Michigan, going to college. My family is down in Virginia. And I have to have this surgery. And I'm like, where am I going to? I'm going to doctor's appointments by myself. I mean, I'm just this little kid, you know, and I'm scared to death. Can you imagine if the physician had come to me and said, you know, Chris, I've never performed the surgery, but I've read a lot about it. Watched some YouTube videos. I've even meditated and deeply reflected on this surgery. Right? I would run, right? I would run for the hills. Because understanding in that realm, it's not what leads to the doing. It's doing that leads to understanding. It's when you actually get into the surgery room and start practicing and working it out that you actually learn and understand the craft. Anybody here play golf? No, you don't. You try to play golf. You try to play because it's a maddening sport. Imagine someone coming to you and saying, hey, I've read all the books. I watched Tiger Woods for years. Every Sunday I'm sitting on the couch. I know the rules. I know how to play golf. But I've never swung a club. Shouldn't be difficult though, right? Right? We think, oh, understanding leads to doing, except, of course, not in that example. We know that you've got to do it in order to understand it. Let me give you one more example. I do a fair amount of premarital counseling with folks, and I love it. I love it because there is so much joy when you get two people together who are about to be married. I mean, it's blissful bliss. It is wonderful, and you can't help like drink a little bit of that sweet drug. But the thing that I get a kick out of, is when a couple says to me, we are so ready to get married. We have read all the books, and we've talked to these people, and we know we are so ready to get married. And I'm like, yeah, come see me in 12 months, and we'll see how ready you were, you know, right? Because you can read all you want to get your understanding, but you don't know something until you've done it. You don't know marriage until you've actually lived it. That's what leads to the understanding. Being a part of a tribe, a family, a community, the way that we get to the understanding part, the way that it kind of makes sense and all of our questions get answered is by doing. By saying to God, I trust you with all my heart. And God, if you say that you are forming a new people, you're taking a bunch of disjointed folks who are just persons, and you're making a new people, a body, a tribe, I trust you. And I will join that, even though not all of my questions have been answered, even though I've seen the carnage and the pain and the dysfunction, I trust you. And so I will say yes. I will say yes to tribe. I wonder what saying yes might look like for you this morning. What might it mean for you to say yes to tribe, to family? I can't answer that. But my hunch is that if you thought about it, it wouldn't take too long to figure it out. For some of you, you're extroverted and you love to interact with people and you're always talking and you seem very engaged, but you are not sharing your life deeply with anyone. And maybe the yes for you is to actually peel back the layers and fully invest all of who you are. Maybe for some of you, it is actually just taking the first step into this community, doing a tangible thing of moving and joining in some way this tribe. Could be small and simple, but maybe that's the yes, the trust that you need to take. Maybe it's reconciliation. Maybe you've said yes and you've invested, but you've been hurt or you've done the hurting. There's some brokenness here in this tribe and you need to take a step towards someone. I don't know what it is. But could we be the people, the new people, that God is joining together, that say, yes, I trust you, God, and I will join in this thing that you are doing. I think that's the invitation to us this morning. And what I want to do is I want to invite you to respond to that invitation in a really tangible way. We're going to take communion here in a second, and often it's probably our default to pass the bread and the cup up and down the rows. This morning, though, I want to invite you to come forward for communion so that your legs and your hands and getting up out of your seat is our tangible yes this morning. By coming forward, we say, all right, God, I trust you, or I'm going to try to trust you with what I have.